World Central Kitchen is serving thousands of fresh meals to Ukrainian families fleeing home, as well as people remaining in the country. This week on Let's Talk About Food, host Louisa Kasdan spoke with Henry Patterson about his upcoming relief trip.
So you're going to Poland, and I think you told me you're going to be there for at least 2 weeks.
I'm going to Poland to help feed Ukrainian refugees. With Jose Andreas's World Central Kitchen, I decided that's what I wanted to do for my 70th birthday. I leave in just a few days. We all see that what the Russians are doing is contemptible. As a food person, we all love to help. It's in our DNA. And here are people who really need our help. So if you want to help the Ukrainian refugees, either with money or even your hands and heart, find hashtag Chefs for Ukraine and World Central Kitchen. We have to do something. We can help. Remember, hashtag Chefs for Ukraine.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Michael Moosbrugger. We'll talk to Michael about Gruner, of course, Riesling, Austria, Schloss Goldelsberg, and a lot more. We'll taste one of Michael's traditions for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Michael Moosbrugger, Austrian-born, grew up around skiing and his family's hotel in Lech Arlberg. Michael jumped into the wine business in 1992 as an apprentice and 4 years later took over the Schloss Goldelsberg winery. He is now the CEO and winemaker of this storied and historic winery. Michael believes in tradition along with innovation. His wines are a true expression of the terroir of Schloss Goldelsberg and Austria. Michael has received numerous awards for his wines, including Wine and Spirits Top 100 Winery of the Year. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Michael.
Welcome on my side.
Was that intro accurate?
Yeah,
everything in there was good?
Yeah, okay, yeah, doing good. Very well.
I just wanted to make sure. Yeah. All right, so we're talking to Michael live in New York City at the Skernick Wine and Spirits office. So it's nice once again to sit across from our guests because we've been doing a lot of remote broadcasting because of the whole COVID thing, but that's starting to ease up. All right, so Michael, we have a lot to cover, okay? You make wine at a winery that dates back to the 11th century. Not everyone can say that. At the Goldelsberg Castle or Schloss Goldelsberg. So everyone gets a sense of where you are, what you're doing, where you wake up. Give me a brief history of the castle, you know, its wine history, the area, and all of that.
Hmm. Well, as you already mentioned, Goldelsberg is one of the oldest estates in Austria and probably also in the today's world of wine. And we have been celebrating 850 years last year. However, winemaking on the estate is much older than that. So when we celebrated the 850th vintage of the estate, it was related to the monastic estate. Settlement on the place starts already in the 16th century before Christ. So the place is settled for about 3,500 to 4,000 years. And was always settled throughout Roman times, Middle Ages, and used to be a classical fortress in the 11th century, was then rebuilt into a Renaissance castle in the 16th century and was brought in what it looks like today between 1725 to 1740 around. And the history of this place is somehow, you know, connected to monastic life and to Cistercians who originally came from Burgundy in the 12th century.
Cistercian monks.
Cistercian monks. Right. You know, I mean, Cistercians played a kind of a major role in the overall development of European vineyards. And there's a very simple reason to that. You have to imagine in the 12th century, monks were some of the only ones who could read and write, and therefore they were the carriers of scientific research. So monks, basically, you know, were trying to find out where are the best places to grow wine. How can we improve grape varieties and wine growing? How can we improve the vinification? And this was rather done on a scientific level. And this is the reason why monasteries and monks were so important for the development of European wine growing up to the time of secularization, so the time of the French Revolution. And whereas in France and in Germany, due to the outcomes of the Enlightenment and the French Revolution, all these monasteries were privatized. In Austria, we had a different history to this question because we had a very Catholic emperor's house with the Habsburg family. And Joseph II made a kind of a compromise with the monks. He said, well, on one side, you know, we have a problem with you. On the other side, you know, you're doing a lot of good things for society. You know, I mean, there's the whole teaching part actually was in the hands of monks. There was retirement houses and hospitals and all. So, you know, the social infrastructure, you know, was quite important. So he said, okay, let's make a compromise. You know, everyone who's into social activity, they shall proceed, and with the rest, we get rid of. And so this is the reason why we still maintain in Austria quite a rich monastic life, you know, with all kinds of different congregations, from Benedictines to Augustines to Cistercians. And this is the reason why the Cistercian monks from Zwettl have been continuing to work the vineyards until quite recently, until 1995. And as you already mentioned, I'm coming from the hotel and restaurant trade. My family runs a small Relais Chateau hotels skiing resort in the Alps.
So let me ask you this. The castle always had vast property around it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where, you know, the monks and even past historically, there was always some kind of vineyard presence, grape growing and mm-hmm. all of that. So the monks get out of there in the 90s. And I'm wrestling with this transition because I do a lot of research and I couldn't, you know, pinpoint it. So your background is in hospitality, which exposes you to a lot, food, wine, people. Mm. When did you make the shift to winemaking, or what was that moment where you knew there's something going on with wine? I'm going to pursue this path.
Yeah, it's as you said. Yeah, I'm coming from the hospitality, and I've been working as a sommelier myself.
So you were working as a sommelier,
exactly. Okay. Exactly. And beside that, my father was the co-founder of the first Austrian Sommelier Association. So wine was always an important issue.
See, I didn't pick up on that. So your background is exactly. fairly extensive in that sense. Did exactly. you study for any certifications or not?
No, I basically.
Trial by fire, you were out there.
I learned it, you know, from scratch, and I was in very good hands, you know, with various different growing wineries. And
let's talk about that. So you had mentors, you had teachers,
exactly. Yes.
You know, Willy Bundelmeier comes exactly. to. Yeah, I mean, yeah. would you say yeah. that's one of the more significant people?
Willy Bundelmeier is a close friend, and I knew him already from my sommelier days. I always liked, you know, his personal approach actually, you know, to winemaking. So whenever there was a real technical question, you know, then Willy was always the one who really could give a good answer actually to that.
Yeah.
So more on a scientific level.
Tie something together for me. So very strong exposure to wine, family, business, sommelier. I asked you this before, tie it together for me. When does that something become a winemaking thing? And the next question is, how does something like Schloss Goebelsberg become available? You know, how do you find out about it? And it's such a vast thing. You know, how does it become a property that becomes your life?
Well, it's, I mean, first of all, you know, is when my brother took over the family business, you know, I went into the growing areas, you know, started to learn about wine. And I basically was looking for an opportunity because I was not bound, you know, to any specific place. So I was looking in Styria, in the Burgenland area, in the Danube area. And I have to say, it was luck and coincidence.
Tell me a little about it.
And it was, well, the situation for the monks, the thing is that there used to be a very famous monk called Father Bertrand. And Father Bertrand, you know, who was, you know, was responsible for the estate between 1958 and 1980 before he became the abbot of the monastery. And he was running as an abbot, he was running then the estate with managers. But he realized that in the future it will be difficult actually for the monks, you know, to have someone here that really has control over the whole thing. And so he said, you know, in order to secure the future of this estate, it will be probably wiser actually, you know, to give it for a certain time, you know, away in other hands. So the monks are still the owners. You know, I took over the relationship with the monks in a long term, so based upon two generations.
So it's almost like a lease.
It is, in a way.
I mean, it's their property, exactly. You have full reign to call the shots.
Exactly.
You know, in the field exactly. and in the winemaking yeah. and all
exactly.
that.
There. Exactly.
Are they involved in any way, or are they go back to doing their own thing?
Not in the direct decision making. However, you know, I always try to keep them involved, you know,
right.
because I think that it's important that they, as the owners, you know, have a strong emotional relationship, you know, to this place. And it has been a part of their life, you know, for the past 800 years. So I think that it's also important that even that they are not operationally currently involved in the whole thing, that they keep at least, you know, a kind of an emotional relation.
I agree.
You
they
know,
should
to
feel
place.
Like yeah, they're, exactly. they're part of it. Are you bound because of the unique situation with the monks, the church, how old it is? Are you bound to any government restrictions or, you know, historic landmarking things, or you could do what you want in the fields? Or?
It is under restrictions because, I mean, Gobelsberg, you know, as a Baroque castle, you cannot do whatever you want.
Right. So, put a 10-story hotel in the middle
exactly,
of the building.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, of course, there are restrictions. And whenever we want to do construction work, you know, we have to deal with them,
right.
And to see, you know, if they give their approval or not, and so on. So, but
right.
but it's, I think it's a kind of a wise, you know, thing, you know, to do, and it's I think we have no bigger problems actually with them.
So, I mean, it's so hard for me to project what this place looks like. So, you know, at the end, I'm going to tell everyone, you know, where they can find the wines and more info. But this is not your ordinary, you know, winery. This is, you know, as we said, it goes back, you know, many years. You're living on the property?
We are living on the property because I think it's essential that someone's living there.
With your wife and kids?
With my wife, my kids, with my parents-in-law. So my parents-in-law also, you know, are very much involved, actually, you
yeah.
know. And so my mother-in-law is looking after the gardens, and my
nice.
Father-in-law is doing, you know, cellar tours and hosting, you know, hosting people coming to the estate.
Which he really loves.
Exactly. And so it's, you know, we're running the place today as a family business, you know. And however, it's also, you know, kind of different. You know,
yeah,
I mean, it's
you hit it on the nose. We're running a family business, yeah. which in the wine business is not yeah. unusual,
yeah.
but it's kind of different,
yeah.
you know, no shit. I mean,
yeah.
it's this amazing, you know, setup. But we'll get into that a little. All right, so let's talk, and we'll weave back into the vineyards and the wines and the castle and all that, you know, as we have our discussion. Since I've been doing this show, there has definitely been an elevated interest in Riesling and Gruner, you know, for sure. A lot of my past guests have been sommeliers, no doubt Riesling, even Gruner is like a somm favorite. Mm-hmm. It's like their secret, you know, favorite thing and all of that. But I think, and I'm not wrong here, that when people think of these wines, they may think of Germany first, mm-hmm. you know, when they think of Riesling. Not so much Gruner, but mm-hmm. they don't know Gruner as mm-hmm. well as Riesling, mm-hmm. and Riesling is starting to have its, you know, comeuppance. So let's talk about, you know, these wines that you make. Tell me about the unique qualities of Austrian wines like Riesling and Gruner. I mean, there's definitely a profile. It's not just another wine. You know, I think you're the guy that could describe specifically these type of wines. Stylistically, you
well,
know.
First of all, you know, I mean, of course, I understand the concept of grape varieties. However, I have to say that we are not primarily producing Gruner Veltlin and Riesling. We are primarily producing the typical wines of origin of the Danube area, of the Austrian Danube area. Now, what is the difference? The difference...
So what you're saying is, listen, these are important wines, but that's hardly everything.
Well...
And the region...
The thing is that, you know, when a winemaker says that he's producing Gruner Veltlin and Riesling, then he puts the specific qualities of a grape variety in the center of attention.
Fair. So, fair enough.
So it's the question is, what is Gruner Veltlin and what is Riesling, you know?
Right.
Well, however, you can also, you know, see it from a different angle. You can say, okay, you have a specific vineyard, and what's the personality of this vineyard that is represented by the grape variety of Riesling? Now, for example, imagine you have a bottle of Clos de Vougeot in front of you. Now, you can pose the question, what is this bottle now? Is this bottle now Pinot Noir that is grown in the Clos de Vougeot vineyard? Or is this wine a Clos de Vougeot that is represented by Pinot Noir?
I think that's the argument almost for all wines.
It's, I mean, you know, it seems to be a game, a language game, but I think it's a little bit more than that. I mean, as I said, you know, when you say it's a Pinot Noir that is grown in the Clos de Vougeot vineyard, it means that the winemaker, you know, is concentrating on the quality of Pinot Noir that is influenced in some way, you know, by this vineyard site.
Right.
But if you say that, okay, this wine is a Clos de Vougeot, that means that my concentration as a winemaker is the question, what is the personality of Clos de Vougeot? And if you're looking the whole thing, you know, in the context of time, then... Clos de Vougeot 200 years ago was something different than what it is today. And then Clos de Vougeot in the 50s and 60s, you know, where they're all added, you know, kind of, you know, Rhone wine or
right.
whatsoever, then it was a very dark expression of Clos de Vougeot, you know. Then the law changed.
Right.
It became 1974. It is what we experience today as what is Clos de Vougeot. But in 100 years, it will be also something different. But it still will be Clos de Vougeot.
Right, yeah? Right. So let me see if I could trip on the same question again, okay? Because that's a fair correction. If you take Austrian wines, and I'm talking very broadly here, and I don't want to spend a ton of time, and people think of Austrian wines and they think of German wines, is there a differentiation generally between the two? Because your correction of me was right. You know, what's the difference between German Riesling and no. But, it, you know, my sense, and maybe this will help, I feel that the Austrian wines are more food friendly.
I think that, you know, when it comes to that question, I think you're absolutely right. I think that, you know, when it comes to the difference between Germany, this is something that is, even though that we have same grape varieties, for example, like Riesling and so on, the difference is the culture of enjoyment. And this is something that is somehow connected to our eating and drinking cultures that we developed over time in Austria and in Germany. And the interesting thing is that I read a few years ago from a German chef that was trying to figure out about the enjoyment of, you know, of German consumers, and he posed the theory that the question of enjoyment in Germany is somehow linked to the confession. There is a big difference between the north of Germany and the south of Germany. You know, we in Germany they say the Weißwurst Äquator, you know, the sausage equator. So the question of the question of enjoyment is very much somehow obviously linked, you know, to the question of Protestantism and Catholicism.
That's a good point.
And this is also, you know, Wilhelm Weil from Robert Weil Estate, he told me actually 3 years ago, he said, Michael, you would not believe, still 80% of Riesling consumption in Germany is outside of the food situation.
Really?
And I was astonished myself, you know, about this. And I said, we could, you know, this is completely different in Austria, because in Austria, nearly 100% of all wine that is produced in Austria is wine that is aimed to be food companion. So our
customers... That's a very specific point.
Exactly. So our culture, and we as winemakers, you know, we were always forced to produce wines that are good food matches. So that means wines needed to be dry.
So dry...
Dry means below 4 grams.
Right. Yeah? So higher than German.
Exactly.
So, and I hate to make direct comparisons, but that's an obvious
one. I mean, you know, I really love German wines and German
Riesling. Yeah, we're not putting them down.
But I think that, you know, wine, I occupied a lot on the history of wine. And what I learned actually, you know, in the history of wine is that wine is always a kind of a reflection of accurate times and culture. No matter if it was in the Greek-Roman times, no matter if it was in the Middle Ages, no matter if it was in the Baroque times or in the Romantic times, you know, somehow, you know, the expression and the personalities of wine were always somehow reflecting, you know, of what people, you know, were eating and drinking and how, in which way they were consuming, actually, you know, these beverages.
Right.
And this still counts for today, you know. And if you have a culture of drinking, you know, wine in the afternoon or after dinner, you know, then you have the possibility of having, you know, a little bit more sweetness in the wines. And if that balances, you know, the wines out more perfectly, you know, then it is a very wise thing to do.
Right.
And
so finished, there were probably a couple of two or three descriptors differentiating what makes them food friendly. Drier, I'm going to guess good acidity.
It is maybe drier, then the acidity is not as high.
Okay.
And there is one crucial differentiation. We are not aiming to make the wines too aromatic. So we are rather fermenting the wines a little bit higher with higher temperatures so that the wines do not have, you know, this kind of primary, you know, exposed and expressive, you know, aromatic
profile. I came across an expression. Does it exist? Non-bouquet?
Non-bouquet. Non-bouquet is good.
Is that to keep the aromatics down?
Why is that? It's very simple. You know, when it comes to matching food and wine, there's a very simple rule. The more aromatic a wine is, the more precise you have to be in matching food and wine.
So it's more friendly.
So the less,
and it may overpower too.
Exactly. The less aromatic, the more universal a wine gets. So if you have, and I think this is also the reason why Grüne Veltliner is such a success in Austria and in meanwhile internationally, that Grüne Veltliner is a fantastic food companion. And you do not have to forget, 80% of the life of the sommelier is that he has a table in front of him where everyone's eating something else. So what does the sommelier need? He needs wine that's
versatile.
That are very versatile.
And yeah. just because it's fish yeah. doesn't mean anything because the sauce may dominate. So you have to think about all these
exactly.
things.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah. That's a very good point. So it sounds like, to oversimplify things, that the Austrians are happier than the Germans, and they make a wine that is incredibly drinkable, well-made, and great with food. Too simple or not bad?
It's very simple. I mean, yeah, you know, I remember very well, actually, you know, when I came 25 years, you know, to Germany, you know, the situation was really, really different to, you know, to what it is today. You know, 25 years ago in Germany, everyone was a little bit skeptical about German wine. Nowadays, you know, the nation is really proud about their wines. Mm. And it's good. You know, I always, you know, I always felt sorry for my colleagues, you know, in Germany, you know, because I mean, if you have a population and country, you know, that is not really proud about what you're doing, you know, I mean, it's really a shame, you know.
Yeah.
It's not good for you know, for the culture of wine, and this is something that really changed, and you know, to a great thank you, you know, to the VDP, you know, that did a tremendous job, you know, in the past 20 years. That really, you know, changed the cards. You
know? I know in Germany, and tell me if this may be true in Austria, that there's a wave of newer, younger winemakers. I've read, and I'm not positive, that property is not crazy in price. You know, when you look at Napa and Burgundy, I mean, to acquire land, it's not as crazy as that. So, you know, so people are coming in. Is there a little of that in Austria?
Of course. I mean, yeah, Austria is a very dynamic country.
Yeah.
And there is a young generation, and there's still, you know, the possibility. You know, if you're young, if you're dynamic, if you can make good wine, and if you, you know, if you can also, you know, do a little bit of good marketing and sales, then
sure.
then you can build up, you know, within one generation, you can build up a fantastic property. You know,
it's crazy.
So,
all right, I want to talk about the vineyards and the wines of Schloss. And like I said before we did this show, we could probably spend a whole show on just the tradition wine. So let's, you know, try to cover as much as we can. The Kassel is in the Comtal region, right by the Danube. So tell me about specifically the Kassel and the vineyards. Just give me an idea of the types of soil. Is there a lot of diversity? Are you dealing with different elevations? Is the climate singular, or you're dealing with, you know, what are you up against every day?
No, I mean the Danube area with the appellations of Wachau, Kremstal, Kamtal, Triesental, Wagram is a fantastic area. It's about the size of today's Côte d'Or, about 10,000 hectares. And it's, by its structure, it's a valley landscape. You know, you have the main valley of the Danube, and then you have the side valleys of the Danube. From the north, you have the river of Krems, which is forming its own valley, and the river of Kemp, which is forming its own valley. And then from the south, from the Alps, you have the valley of the Triesen. And in German, Tal means valley, so the name of Kamtal translates into the valley of the Kemp River.
Ah.
So this is the systematics behind, you know,
sure.
Kremstal is the valley of the Krems River and so on.
Sure.
So, what is quite important to understand actually in this area is that what unites this area and all these appellations is the soil, because you find the geology is everywhere basically the same. You have mainly you have three types of soil. You have primary rock, which is coming from the Bohemian mass. It's a brownish peregnite with high content of mica. Then you have alluvial soil. So, you know, the Danube in the past millions of years went through different parts of the area and have been depositing structures. And then you have loess, which is coming from the chalk Alps. Here during the glacier time, when the when the glacier is going over the rock, sharpening up tiny particles, which is washed out by the water and is picked up by the sand and transported and deposited then according to the structures in the area. So you can have on the southern and eastern slopes, you can have meter-high structures of loess covering, you know, the structures. And then on the northern and eastern side or western side is it's only, you know, tiny layers. But so that's basically in all of these appellations. When it comes to climate, it's a little bit more difficult because you always have to consider the construction of a valley.
Right.
You know, that you're starting at a lower point, and the more you go up in the valley, the more you gain in altitude, and the more you gain in altitude, the higher it gets and the cooler it gets, until it's getting that cold that, you know, you reach the end of the winemaking zone. And basically all these appellations, they're all working up to the limit. So in the Wachau behind Spitzergraben, it's finished with winemaking. And in the Kremstal behind Senftenberg, it's finished. And then in the Kamtal behind Schönberg, it's finished and so on. And so that's bringing you to quite some significant differences within the appellations.
Right.
You know, so the lower parts and the higher parts. And in terms of harvest, that counts for about 2 to 3 weeks in harvest time.
Difference?
Yeah. And
aren't we dealing with valley vineyards and sloped,
exactly,
tiered vineyards
And
exposures, like you said.
Exactly. And this is exactly what you find, you know, when you're coming to this area, you instantly see that you're looking to two general types of vineyard sites. You know, you have on one side, you have terraced vineyards along the Danube and the side rivers of the Danube. So vineyards that are very dry.
Which is very Moselle-like.
Exactly. So very dry, high mineralization, ideal for Riesling production. On the other side, we have vineyards based on loess, on clay. So vineyards with good water supply to the wines, which is ideal for Grüner Veltliner. So Grüner Veltliner and Riesling are complementary grapes. So what one likes, the other doesn't like, and the other way around. And as we have those two opposing structures, we need the two grape varieties to cover the needs of these vineyards.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Broad question, but I'm sure there's, you know, a commitment or a philosophy. Farming practices. How do you approach that? I don't want to use any buzzwords, but... Are you subjected to tough conditions where you have to think about treatments or not? Or how do you try to farm?
Well, the thing is that you have to think that, you know, what was the original aim actually for the monks to grow wine? I mean, the original aim was mess wine, altar wine. And
a specific purpose.
Exactly. So the definition of mess wine is that it cannot be altered neither by technology nor by chemicals or so. It's nature wine by definition, you know. Now, and this is something that is carried out, you know, in the vineyards and in the cellar work and everywhere.
Not really changed?
Because,
you know, in France, a farmer literally would farm like that, and then the war came and, you know, business changed, so they had to grow, you know, not quicker, but bigger, you know, so they started doing treatments, killed the land. There was never really a shift or a disrespect to the land that way?
You see, in our vineyards never ever have seen, you know, insecticides or herbicides, you know. So it's we have always been trying, you know, to bring these vineyards as good as we can into the next generation.
That's great.
And
does that follow through into the cellar practices? You know, simplification in the wine making. Nothing
this
really added or taken out.
You know, one of the principles of Cistercian belief is strictness and simplicity. And this is something that I've always been following. You know, this is when you're reading, you know, my first brochures that I did actually in 1996 or 1997. You know, this is already laid down during a time when no one was talking about natural wine, orange wine, whatsoever.
But it was a 900 year tradition that nobody thought about.
Exactly.
I mean, that's a great point, because that's why I said no buzzwords.
Yeah.
You know, this is the way it was. So, and it's not like some vineyards and winemakers inherited land and eventually were able to turn it around. by going to these practices. It's always been that way, mm-hmm. you know, which is a beautiful thing. And obviously, and I'm sure, that reflects in the quality of the grape, the mm-hmm. taste growing and all mm-hmm. of that, which is a beautiful thing. Let's talk about some of the wines, as many as we can. You know, I want to talk about the tradition program. I know you make sparkling wines. I do not want to pass up on discussing the reds a little because they're exciting. Are the wines classified? I mean, when you know, I came across a word. Is it reed or ride?
Yeah. Well, you see,
I mean, your wines. How do you?
We are mainly we are producing wines of origin. So this is actually, you know, our main focus. So in the, you know, we have an appellation system in the Danube area that is quite simple to understand. That is differentiating between three categories of wine. You have the wines of the region. You have the wines of the villages, and you have the wines of the single vineyards. Now, the single vineyards in Austria, they are called Ried, like Riedel without the L.
Yeah? Okay.
And why is that so important? Because in Austria, we have about 4,300 single vineyards. Not even we know all these names.
Right.
So this is why we made it obligatory that when we want to indicate a single vineyard name on the label, it has always to be in conjunction with the term of Ried. So it's always Ried Heiligenstein, Ried Lamm, Ried Geisberg, Ried Renner, and so on. So, you know, for you, the good thing for you is that instantly you see this trigger word of Ried on the label, you instantly know, okay, this is a wine, is a single vineyard wine, you know?
So like Grand Cru, Premier Cru, you know, it's Ried exactly. is
Ried,
it's
Ried
gonna is, be singular vineyard.
Exactly.
Single vineyard, and it'll be the quality vineyard yeah, yeah.
So,
and wine.
So Ried is the historical and legal indication also in our wine law, you know, that indicates a single vineyard. And means basically nothing else than Cru. Yeah?
Right.
It means nothing else than Cru.
Right.
And so this is the appellation system. Beside the appellation system, we are also are working on a vineyard classification system. So for the past 30 years, there's an association called Österreichische Traditionsweingüter, so the Austrian Association of Traditional Wineries. And this private association is working for the past 30 years already on a vineyard classification system. And now the government actually wants to take over actually this classification into the wine law. So this is...
Are you happy with the progress?
This is...
Is it going where you want it to go?
We are hoping that everything is well done. And if it's well done, you know, then it's really worthwhile actually, you know, okay. to follow that.
But is it being done well? I mean...
It's on progress. I mean, you okay. know, we
and the winemakers and owners exactly, are certainly exactly. on
so,
top of it.
So it's like in Burgundy, we are differentiating between Erste Lage, Große Lage, which is equivalent to Premier Cru and Grand Cru. And so coming back, yes, these vineyards are classified, you know, that we are working and that we are vinifying also then separately. And so these wines, so these appellation wines and so on, that's basically, you know, the core of our production.
Right.
Yeah. And beside that core, we're doing four specialties. So there's the quality sparkling production. Langenlois, the center of the Kamptal appellation, became in the meantime the...
What is Langenlois? Is that an area?
It's a village.
It's the village.
It's the village
okay.
name. It's the village name.
Okay.
And Langenlois became...
So that's the center for your sparkling wines, Langenlois?
Exactly. And Langenlois is the epicenter for quality sparkling in Austria. So there's, you know, Willy Brunnelmeier and Leumer and Jurcic and Topf and Steining and so Gobelsberg. So it's, you know, in this area, sparkling became somehow, you know, a certain importance. And so we're doing four different cuvées, a Brut Reserve, a Blanc de Blanc, a Brut Rosé, and a vintage that is released after 10 years. So so this is a small assortment of
the
sparkling
wines.
The
10 years is an aged sparkler.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's 10, nice.
Yeah.
All right, so
and then beside the sparkling, then there is a little bit of sweet wine. Right. Yeah, Auslese, Bernauslese, Trockenmännerse.
And it's funny that it's only a little bit. In Germany, well, it's a lot of bit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but I mean, I mean, sweet wine is not a huge segment nowadays anymore. But still, you know, we have quite a reputation actually in that field as well. And you already mentioned the red wines.
Let's talk about some of the red wines.
We are not producing red wine because we also want to have red wine. I mean, we are producing red wine because a certain percentage of our vineyards are based on these river sedimentation from the original Danube. The Danube was not always as regulated as today, so it went through very different parts in the past millions of years. So a certain amount of vineyards we have, especially in the south of Gobelsberg, we have where we have these kind of feast-sized river pebbles, you know, these like the Galeroulet, like the, it looks like in the Rhone Valley.
Yeah? Right.
And in these vineyards, you have a good drainage in the soil, so water is running away, you're running into early dry stress situation over the summer month. This is something that we don't like at all for white wine production. So in these vineyards, we're going then for red wine production, and we have an old tradition for Pinot Noir, you know, through the Cistercians, and we are looking after the three generations of Pinot. So Pinot Noir, Saint Laurent, Zweigelt. So these are basically the red wines that we are looking after.
So, not to repeat, but Pinot Noir and Zweigelt. Mm-hmm. I don't think people know a lot about Zweigelt. I mean, quickly, how
it's,
would you?
Zweigelt is a fairly interesting grape variety. It's in the meantime, it's the principal grape variety, red wine grape variety of Austria. So it's the widest planted red wine grape variety of Austria, and has a kind of an authentic character like Grüner Veltliner. It's a grape variety that is really, you know, that is really recognized to be an Austrian grape, and the grandmother of Zweigelt is Pinot Noir.
Ah, so there's a lineage or a genetic connection.
There's a genetic connection, you know, via Saint Laurent. Because Saint Laurent is a genetic child.
Saint Laurent is the variety, right?
Exactly.
There's Zweigelt and Saint Laurent.
Yeah.
What's the difference?
Saint Laurent is a grape variety that came in the mid of the 19th century from France to Germany and from Germany to Austria. And in France, due to phylloxera, died out, does not exist in France anymore, but survived in Austria. And I always say that, you know, when Saint Laurent, you know, became a kind of an immigrant to Austria, and, you know, this immigrant started to have a love affair with the great variety of Blaufränkisch.
That's funny.
And out of this relationship, you know, you get the great variety of Zweigelt, you know. And
So two quick questions on Saint Laurent. They make a still and a sparkling, or is it? Sparkling nice.
Saint Laurent is a grape variety that you hardly can differentiate from Pinot Noir.
Okay.
In the vineyards. However, it's much darker, so the color is much more intense than Pinot Noir.
Right.
And it's a little bit more spicier. So reminds a little bit something. I have friends in the Rhone Valley. When I was tasting with them Saint Laurent, they said, well, for them, it reminds them, you know, something in between Syrah and Pinot Noir.
I like that.
Yeah.
You know, if you're dealing with two good, grape varietals, to be in between is pretty good. Michael, we have to take a quick break. We're talking to Michael Moosbrugger from Schloss Gobelsberg in Austria. When we come back, I want you to talk about the tradition wines and the tradition wine program. Towards the end of the show, we're going to taste special tradition, so I want to get to that. So you're listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back.
This episode is supported by HRN business member Radical Wine, a small neighborhood wine and spirit shop in Clinton Hill, Brooklyn, that specializes in natural wine and regional-based spirits. Radical Wine is a shop where community can hang out and listen to records while finding a delicious bottle of wine for any occasion. Grab a bottle from the shop to bring to their sister restaurant, Brooklyn Hots, which is right next door. Radical supports HRN's creative, educational reporting and storytelling that drive conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place.
Hi, I'm Katie Mosman-Wadler, Executive Director of HRN. HRN is dedicated to amplifying small businesses that keep our communities vibrant. Today, I'm asking business owners to take part in our business membership drive by supporting HRN's mission with a $500 membership. HRN will shine a light on your work, and you'll help sustain our mission to expand the way eaters think about food. As a thank you for this tax-deductible donation, your business will receive on-air mentions, social media posts, listings on our website, and more. You'll also play an essential role in keeping nonprofit food radio on the air. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/biz to become a business member today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/biz. Thank you for your support.
All right, we're back. We're back with our guest, Michael from Schloss Goebelsberg. I think an important piece, part, thing of Schloss Goebelsberg are the tradition wines. I told you before the show, I have a bunch of past vintages and enjoyed them. But you've embarked, I guess, on this 850th anniversary mission project. Tell me about the tradition wines, and then let's talk about where we're at with them now, you know, the celebration, the wines you're making. And again, off air, we talked about a different way of making them.
Well, the tradition wines is one of the four specialties that we're doing in Goebelsberg. And I started to go into this project in the late 90s because when I took over the responsibility on the estate, I occupied first on the history of the estate, and then, but then soon I started actually, you know, to go into the question, well, but, you know, I mean, I have so many predecessors now here on this estate, how did they work actually here, you know? And so I started to occupy on the question on the historical developments of winemaking. So how was wine made in the Greek-Roman times, in the Middle Ages, 17th, 18th, 19th century?
Where were you researching this? Were there books and materials and records at the winery? Yeah. Did you have to go outside? Yeah.
You are sourcing actually all kinds of different sources in that, because when you're looking for Greek and Roman winemaking, you're finding more information actually in archaeology than in historical books on wine. If you're looking to Hugh Johnson's wine history, for example, there is not much about actually the real winemaking process, actually,
right.
You know, it's so you're digging out, you know, things, you know, from all different fields, and then of course, I mean, there's literature. There's not much literature actually up to the 18th century. It's getting then a little bit more in literature about winemaking then from the 18th and especially then in the 19th century. Then more and more is then written about winemaking. That has something to do also that farmers became free. And there was a certain need, actually, you know, for literature and for learning and all that. We also have documentations, of course, in the library of the monastery. And so putting all that together, you know, is giving you a picture. And I decided in 2001 to go for this very specific period between the French Revolution and the mid-19th century. So the period about 200 years ago. Why this period? It's easy. You're looking in these days, you're looking to an empirical knowledge of 2,000 years of winemaking on one side.
Right.
On the other side, it's a period that is not yet really influenced by the outcomes of the classical industrial question. So it's starting around 1850 that winemakers and scientists are posing the very classical question, how can we produce wine in bigger quantities and in a shorter period of time? And this has been leading then to a series of innovation, the first filtration machines, for example, new pressing systems. 1870, you have Pasteur inventing the pasteurization. Very important. It was the first time that you could bring sweet wines stable on a bottle. So this was a significant game changer, actually, you know, for the Mosel area, for example. Daniel Deckers, who is the expert on German history of wine, told me a few years ago that pasteurization was one of the major aspects, you know, that suddenly made go Mosel wines actually through the roof in these days.
But no effect to the quality of the wine or the,
well, it's,
you know, everything about a wine, well, its nose, its mouthfeel, yeah, its palate. Did it?
It's nowadays, you know, nowadays it's something that we definitely, and also my colleagues in the Mosel would never do, of
right,
course.
It made sense then, and it was essential
but
then.
In these days, yeah, it made sense, and it was really, you know, the most important thing for them, you know, because it meant, you know, to have a possibility, you know, to bring these wines with that structure, with low alcohol, high acidity, and certain sugar levels, actually, you know, stable on a bottle that was not possible before.
Right. So the tradition, like I said, you make tradition wines that share similar labels to the other wines. This particular, you know, wine is a celebration, an anniversary. You know, this is where we're at now. Tell me about this.
Well, I started in 2001, actually, with this project. And I originally started to produce a Grüner Veltliner and a Riesling tradition. Until quite recently, until with the vintage 2017. I decided in 2009 to start to put wines in cask aside for later releases. And
I said to you earlier, reminds me of champagne.
Yeah.
Fair assessment.
Yeah.
To hold vintages, yeah, for later blending.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and that was 2009 you started
this,
that?
2009 I started with that. And in the meantime, we are looking to a reserve cellar with more than 100,000 liters that we keep in stock.
It's a big commitment.
And I decided last year to change the tradition concept. And instead of bringing every year a Grüner Veltliner and Riesling tradition, I will bring a 3-year-old and a 10-year-old tradition. So changing from the varietal concept to the concept of maturity. And
so when you say the 3-year-old, the oldest wine in that wine is 3 years old. And
exactly.
The 10, you go back to the vintages that you just...
No. The youngest wine is 3-year-old.
The youngest.
Yeah.
That's what I meant.
Yeah. The youngest wine is 3-year-old.
Right. The last guy in is the youngest.
A little bit,
right. You
some,
have to
some
declare
older parts.
That.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Right. So no more single Grüner, no more single Riesling, mm-hmm, blended. And when was the first vintage?
And last year in 2021 we made the first edition. This is also something kind of new, and you know, kind of, I would not say revolutionary, but it's, you know, it's breaking a little bit with you know, with old traditions, because you know, if, normally in the world of wine, you know, there is no debate actually about vintages. And and this is something when you're looking to the wines of the past, is not something that is really God given. You know, I mean, this is certainly, there were always, you know, wines of vintages, but the majority of wine, you know, was something that was always kind of blended.
Right.
And I was looking into our inventories, you know, and I realized that, you know, my predecessors in our cellars in the past hundreds of years, they had, beside the accurate vintages, always back vintages. So wines that were 5, 10, 15 years or older, you know. And it was always kind of, and You know, vintages were in these days a little bit more different than they are nowadays. You know,
right.
Today's with our regulations, green harvest, and you know, all the possibilities that we have nowadays, vintages are a little bit more even. They vary certainly over the years, but they're in comparison to what our predecessors have been facing, they're a little bit more even. In 200 years ago, you know, vintages could be very, very different, you know?
Right.
So from very, very ripe to really, really austere and so on. So it was kind of natural, you know, to blend vintages. And you have to see that, you know, the minimum time of maturation in these days was minimum 3 years. So because if you want to produce a wine that is clear, you know,
right,
without filtration, you know, then you need time.
Time helps with clarity.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay.
And the concept of luxury in these days was clarity, you know, because it was the proof that these wines, you know, were for at least 3 years, you know, in the cellars and had their maturation time.
So much for the natural wine movement. But that's another discussion.
The natural wine movement is, in my eyes, actually the most modern way of vinification. Even though that natural wine producers are always and very often are claiming, you know, that they are looking back, you know, to historical and da da da, but it's not really true. Because there is a significant difference between, you know, what is really, you know, traditional winemaking and what natural wine is actually about. Natural wine is by definition, I personally define it as a non-intervention way of winemaking.
Agree.
Yeah. And this is something to do, you know, with our self side as winemakers and how we see ourselves, you know, in this process. There's a significant difference, you know, to how winemakers saw themselves 200 years ago. I mean, today, and natural winemakers and also myself, you know, we see us as non-interventionalists. You know, so the great art, the art of making great wine is to do nothing, you know, and great wine is made in the vineyard.
But you said earlier, the monks weren't talking about it. That's what they did.
But 200 years ago, you have to imagine that people had a different self-perception. So they said, you know, because in these days, wine was rather compared to us as human beings. They said, wine is like us. And as we humans have to undergo certain developments until we are grown-ups, also wine has to undergo certain developments. As we humans have to breathe, you know, to do all these developments, also wine has to breathe. The consequence was that they were wrecking the wines from cask to cask, in order that the wine could breathe again to trigger the next step of the development process and to go off the lees. Also one of the significant differences to today, because there was no filtration, so the wines needed to be clear, so they went off the lees and
right.
off the lees and so on, until the wine was really clear. Now, the self-perception of the winemaker was that I am the cellar master. The wine was my pupil. The process of this, you know, of this wrecking and so on was called the teaching of the wine. In German, die Schulung. In French, élevage.
Ah.
Yeah? See?
Yep.
Yeah? So that means my responsibility and my relationship actually to the wine is not the non-intervention. My relationship is that I have to educate this wine. So that means that my responsibility is to understand the potentials of this wine and to educate him right, that he would develop up to his potentials. So this is direct intervention. This is direct forming. This is, if you compare it with education, what is the modern word of what we're doing nowadays with education? The non-authority education.
Right.
Yeah. Anti-authority
right.
education. So
right.
anti-authority education, this is natural winemaking, you know?
It's the similar form.
Exactly.
That's interesting. It's very well said, you know, the way you said that, because in a sense, It is very much intervention, but in a different way. But in other ways, it's not. All right, so we have to finish up on a few things. So last year, celebrating the 850th anniversary was the first tradition in the winemaking way you described, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Is this the bottle in front of us, the tradition?
And it's not vintage anymore. It's an addition.
Right.
So it says on the side, if you're looking at that.
That's what I wanted to get to. How do I know what edition
it
is?
There is 850? Edition 850.
Am I silly to think the next one is 851?
Or? Exactly. Okay. The next one is 851.
Okay.
And so on.
But, and I don't want to do this, but this edition came out in 2021?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Which the vintage year has nothing to do with that. I just want to. Okay. And when can we expect the next edition?
In September.
September, like normal, you know, cycle and all that. All right, so that's, you know, an incredibly interesting project, the Schloss Goldelsberg tradition. That's really, you really made some incredible changes, which make the wine more interesting. All right, couple things before we wrap up. I don't know if I told you this, but one of the things we're going to do is taste the wine and talk about it. But I do a thing called the wine list. I ask all my guests, every show, nobody gets away, 5 questions. I've asked everyone the same 5 questions.
Yeah.
So you're not being singled out or I didn't give you any hard questions. So no complaining. You don't have to dwell on the answers. It's spontaneous, impulsive. I post these on our social media. You know, a guy like you that is so steeped in tradition and winemaking and an interest, you know, people want to hear, you know, what you're drinking. So here's the first question. What are you drinking now? What's in your fridge at home? What are you tasting? You know, what are you curious about? Other than maybe tasting through your wines, what are you drinking now?
Well, beside Goldelsberg, beside Goldelsberg, it's sherry, Madeira, and Shiraz.
So has that been going on for a while, or you've been intrigued lately by them and you've really been drinking more of that?
No, I mean, these are, I made 5 years ago, I made a symposium on the most important wine styles of the 19th century and their significance for today. So here we had Madeira, we had Sherry, we had, unfortunately there was no Jura because I could not find anyone who would come. We had Moselle with Daniel Deckers, and we have Tokaj. And you know, today, I mean, you know, most winemakers, they're so concentrated on reduction and reductive winemaking. I'm personally occupying on historical questions. I'm more actually, you know, into the question of oxidation. And this is why I'm so interested.
Sherries and Madeiras are very oxidative wines, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So this is why I'm so interested in, and also tradition is oxidative winemaking, you know? And
you're intrigued by the category. All right, that's a good answer. We're talking vintage stuff, old stuff, you know, for sherry and Madeira. I mean, you're trying everything. All right, second question, maybe the silliest question in the group, but we love wine. We love food. You came from hospitality. Give me your favorite wine and food pairing. Not what you and I think is a good one, what you like. You don't eat it all the time, but when you do, what is that wine and food that is just the magical pairing? Can you think of anything? Don't overthink it.
No, well, you know, when it comes to my favorite food, it's probably the stuffed veal breast of my wife.
Okay.
And for that, I definitely, you know, prefer to have at least 10-year-old Riedlam. So this is probably my favorite.
All right. So that's, you know, when you think about it, that reoccurs and those are favorites. So that's a good answer. You should be able to answer this, and you're kind of a global guy because you've been traveling the country and, you know, you travel Europe. Do you have a favorite wine restaurant and or bar, or a couple? Is there something by the winery when you hit the road, either in Europe or here? Is there a restaurant or two where the selection is great, the people are terrific, the vibe is great? You know, you just go in there. And by answering this, you're not saying this is my favorite and you're not leaving anyone out. Just what comes to mind?
Well, I mean, favorite wine places in Vienna is definitely Coburg, Palais Coburg.
That's the name of the place, Coburg?
Yeah, Palais Coburg, yeah.
Spell that for me, because I'm going to post.
C-O-B-U-R-G.
Okay. So that's a good one.
So that's a fantastic.
And the winery is what, less than 2 hours outside of Vienna or even closer?
It takes me 45 minutes into the opera, you know.
It's like the suburbs.
Exactly.
All right. Is there any other place that comes to mind? Anything in the U.S. or anything outside of Austria?
Well, I mean, 67 Pall Mall, for example.
In London.
In London.
Yeah. Terrific wine place. It's those are two good ones.
And then, of course, Aldo's place here in New York is a must go.
Well, you have Aldo Som Wine Bar and you have Le Bernardin.
Yes.
Right? They're both great. Yeah. I was going to ask you about Aldo. He's been on the show a couple of times. Yeah. He's making his own wine with Crocker. Yeah. So that's interesting. All right. So those are good answers. All right. Fourth question. Favorite all-time wine. When I started the show many years ago, I wanted to get guys like you in a room and ask you this question, and I wanted you to tell me the most expensive rare wine you ever drank. I don't care about that anymore. What is the wine in your lifetime that was a gateway wine that had an impact on you, that was important, that changed the way you think about it? Is there a wine or two that fits in that category? And that certainly doesn't mean price or rarity of vintage. It means impact to you.
Yeah, well, impact to me, I mean, I would say, let's say, two wines. So first of all, my real wine flash, my first real wine flash, was a 1983 Hermitage from Julie Jaffe.
Okay, that always works.
And it's
83.
And it's a wine because my brother was working in summertime a few weeks for Pic in Valence. And Schaaf was doing the house wine for the Pick family in these days, and so the old Pick went with my brother actually to see Schaaf, and from this visit, my brother brought me a bottle of Hermitage 83, and I still, you know, I was in university and this was really my first wine.
Nothing
flash.
Like it.
It was not.
I mean, it's. Yeah. Truly one of the great wines anyway. The fact that you caught it at that time, it made the impression.
I still have the bottle in my office.
You do?
Yeah. Okay. The second one I would define as a Heiligenstein 67. This was a wine that I tasted, I think, 3 or 4 years ago.
Is this a Schloss Heiligenstein?
Schloss Gobelsberg, Heiligenstein 67. This wine was as young as you could
imagine.
When
did you taste it?
Yeah, 3-4 years ago.
And it was unbelievable.
And it was just unbelievable. Jesus. And, you know, we have been just been tasting here in this office 50 years of Heiligenstein, so back to 1971. And it shows, actually, you know, it shows the potentials of the Danube area, I think. And it's not, I'm not talking only about Gobelsberg and our wines. I think that,
I think it goes beyond that.
Exactly. It goes beyond
the region.
That, I think, I
has
think
the ability.
You know, what the Danube region has to offer, I think, and this is for me one of the most fantastic things, is that when you're looking to the greatest white wines in the world, I mean, they're always wines with depth and concentration on one side, but on the other side always, you know, with this element of easiness. They're always easy to drink, you know. They have a high level of enjoyment and drinkability, you know. And I think this is exactly what the Danube has to offer.
I think that's a good offering.
And this is, you know, this is what showed me, you know, that these wines are not only good, you know, when they're young, 5 or 10
right.
years. They are still fantastic after 50 years.
That's a great tribute to the wines, the winemakers in the region. All right, last question, and. Shouldn't be hard because I think we're in a category that makes sense here. The question is, I want you to recommend to me the best wine around $15, $20, $22 American dollars retail. And the setup has always been, my kids are in their 20s now. They can't show up at a dinner party with a crappy bottle of wine for $12. Mm-hmm. They can't afford $50. Mm-hmm. So what's a good value at $15, $20, $22? Give me a red and a white. Now, you can give me a region. You can give me a maker. Now, I have a strong feeling, and I need you to validate this, that there are some incredible values in Austria in both of these categories around these price ranges. Can you address that, or is it a little more?
Well, I would say, first of all, of course, the Kamptal, Veltliner, and Riesling, these are wines in that price range.
Okay.
So the regional expression of the Danube region, so Kamptal, these are fantastic
quality to value.
Quality to value wines.
Right.
And the Kamptal Riesling last year was rated within the top 100 Wine Spectators.
So you're talking everything.
And
critical acclaim, exactly. Price, yeah. Value, yeah. And all
so
of that.
So here you get it all.
What yeah. about red? Yeah. You have to go outside of winery Austria, whatever you think is a good value.
I could say now, of course, now at Zweig, but let's say outside of Austria, I would say Beaujolais.
Beaujolais?
Yes.
At the village level?
At the village level.
Okay. I agree with that. What stinks is it used to be really reasonable, and through the years, yeah. It's not that cheap anymore. All right, Michael, you did an excellent job on that, okay? And I saw you roll your eyes when I told you had to do this, so you did well. All right, we wrap up the show with a segment called the Weekly Wine Sip. Mm-hmm. And what that is certainly when I have a winemaker as a guest, I think it's always a good idea to taste their wines and have the opportunity to discuss it with them. Mm-hmm. So I asked you and Abby, you know, to pick something for the show today. And I think you hit a home run here. So we have the Tradition Cuvée 10 Years Edition 850. Mm-hmm. All right. We talked about the Tradition program. But again, tell me more about this specific wine.
Well, the Tradition 10 Years is a wine where the youngest parts have been matured for 10 years in cask. So here you have a blend of Grüner Veltliner. It's mainly Grüner Veltliner, but with a small percentage of Riesling as well.
Does that vary by vintage? You'll determine the blends.
Exactly. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Yeah. And then you have vintage 2010, which is the biggest part, and then you have smaller parts that coming from 2009 and a few older parts actually of that.
Okay.
And it's a wine that has a really really nice and decent perfume.
I'm going to go through the vitals now, mm-hmm. All right? And you'll walk me through it. Let's go with color. It's a very deep yellow.
It's a deep yellow.
It's not a pale yellow. No. I mean, it's beautiful golden.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a golden yellow.
Yeah, which is very mm-hmm. eye-catchy when yeah. you pour it in yeah. the glass. Yeah. All right, so that's the color. Let's put it up to the nose and tell me your nose descriptors on this wine. And again, we discussed non-bouquet earlier, but what are
yeah,
we getting?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think it's a nice and complex bouquet.
It is nice and complex, yeah. And it's evolved a little because yeah, it's yeah. some older wines,
yeah.
which is nice.
Exactly, yeah.
All right, let's.
So there's no primary aromas actually in this.
Right.
One. Yeah.
It's. I agree.
It's
with
all
that.
Secondary and tertiary aromas.
Move off of the subject for a minute, and then we need to come back to it. I think one of the things people get with Austrian wines and German wines is that petrol nose. Mm-hmm. What causes that? I mean, why is that? Is that from the soils? Is that from the vintage?
No, winemaking. This petrol thing is very simple. There's two components that are leading actually to extensive petrol notes. First of all, it's sun exposure of the grapes, which is leading to these elements that are, you know, going to this petrol. And the other element is maturity. So if you're harvesting too early, then you also get these kind of petrol notes.
So based on maturity, if you underpick,
exactly.
So I got you.
It's a part. You know, the component that is responsible for that is something that is distinctly, you know, in combination with Riesling. But these two components are leading based. So if you, this is why we are shading our Riesling grapes always, you know, to the sun. So that our grapes are not exposed
with leaf canopy or
with leaf pan okay. canopy, yeah.
Okay.
So we are not taking leaves out. So we leave so we are taking on the northern sides we take the leaves out, but on the southern side we leave the leaves.
Interesting.
And on the other side, then it's important that the grapes are harvested with decent maturity.
Right. All right, so I said we don't want to spend too much time. So now we're coming back to our tasting of the Tradition 850. Let's talk about mouthfeel. Mm-hmm. You got to throw it over the tongue to get a feel for it.
Yeah, it's a medium-bodied wine.
I say medium plus in a good way.
Medium.
It's not unctuous, but it's mouth coating, but not glycerin-y.
And you have here. It's in contrary to the classical wines that we are producing. It has a different texture here on the mid palate.
Yes.
Yeah.
It stays too.
Yeah.
Which is nice. All right, so now let's talk about the palate. Are some of the descriptors on the nose in the palate, or the palate introduces some new, you know, flavors or descriptors?
I think that they correlate pretty well.
Okay.
So when I'm smelling and I'm tasting,
what are the 2-3 things when you just think of palate?
The thing is that you think about how wine consumption was done 200 years ago. I mean, this wine is about wines of the 19th century, early 19th
right.
century.
Yeah? You've proven yourself to be a history buff,
we have a traditional guy. We have now a beautiful glass. I think it's the Chances Robinson glass.
Yes. JRRB.
I mean, you know, we in Austria...
Abby told me to save you some of this, but I have to keep tasting it.
In Austria, we are very lucky, actually, you know, to have some of the best glass producers in Austria with Riedel and with Zalto. So we are tasting a lot. But this glass is also fantastic, Chances Robinson's glass. But think about people 200 years ago did not have these glasses.
No.
They were drinking out of toothbrush cups. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
So it didn't open up. It didn't sit in a nice bowl.
So if you Google, you know, for, you know, glassware 19th century, then you see, you know, you hardly could smell anything with these glasses. So you know, in the perception of wine lovers 200 years ago, you know, the smell of a wine was not important.
I know. Yeah?
So that means, you know, the whole perception of the wine was rather done. You know, on the palate. Today, when we are enjoying wine, you know, there's about 2/3 of the pleasure that we take is coming from the smell.
Right. Yeah? People don't realize it. It's happening, but they don't realize it.
You know, when but in these days, it was just the other way around.
Right. Yeah? But you're drinking out of a toothbrush cup.
Yeah.
Let's talk about this particular wine and what kind of foods would go well with this.
This wine, I mean, you can drink it, you know.
Eva's stuffed veal?
Of course.
Okay.
I mean, it's a stylistic expression that is, in a way, universal, you know. I mean, it's not extreme in one or the other side.
I agree.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that opens it up to
that
a
opens
lot of,
up to quite a lot
but
of
But what's
options.
The primary recommendation on this? I mean, what's...
You can have that for Wiener Schnitzel in the same way, you know, as
you could have it with a roast chicken or salmon the,
exactly.
or...
I mean, there's no... I
even
mean,
a salad or something.
There's only a few limitations to it, and one of the limitations is goulash.
Not good with goulash?
Goulash.
You got the noodles, you got the sauce, you got the meat. Well, too much going on, right?
In our world, actually, goulash is accomplished, you know, with beer.
So I was just going to say, while I have you talking about goulash, so beer is the best pairing?
Exactly.
Okay, yes. Good for that. All right, so that is the Schlossgobelsberg tradition, heritage, cuvée 10 years. It's the 850th. It's edition 850 in celebration. And this is in the market now, right?
Mm.
And come this fall, the next edition. So we're really at the exciting and early stages of this particular project, which is very cool. So if I cracked open one of my traditions, let's say from 2016, that is a singular vintage year wine, right? Versus this, which is a whole...
Yep.
I mean, it's just crazy where you took this project. Congratulations on it. All right, Michael, we have to wrap up. Let me do a quick closing, and I want to get some information from you. So if you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. I always say if you hit the subscribe button, the podcast will be sent to you automatically, and within 24 hours, you will be an expert on Austrian wines. Thank you to Michael. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. On Instagram, we're at SBenRuby, and on Twitter, we're at BenRuby, but you can always use the hashtag The Grape Nation to get to us on both. As I mentioned, we'll post Michael's wine list answers. There's some great recommendations there. And our weekly wine sip, I'll give you the information specifically on this wine, so if you want to look at it. So, Michael, if we want to follow Schloss on social media, follow you, or we want to find out more information online, where are the places we should go to?
Well, we have an Insta account that is run by my son.
Okay.
So, and
that's important. And I'm glad you got him.
Gabe and Abby already had great fun actually with that.
So is it Schloss Gobelsberg? Where do we get to it?
Yeah, Schloss Gobelsberg. Okay. Yeah.
So that's Schlossgobelsberg. Schloss Gobelsberg. Okay. Then where else?
Mm-hmm. Facebook. Which is run by my wife.
Okay, got the whole family.
And then there is the website at gobelsberg.it.
Okay,
where you get all the information on the wines.
It's a very rich site.
On the tradition heritage 10 years, where you get all the information about the wines, the history, the traditions, and the castle architecture, everything that you want.
This interview doesn't do justice to the history. The castle, the amount of wines you're making. I'd rather get into a few things and do that well than be all over the place. But I recommend people to go on, you know, the site and really, it's a special place. And when Gabe at Skernick reached out, you know, I was happy to hear from that and I wanted to talk to you. So in closing, I want to thank our guest, Michael Mosbroger. From Schloss Gobelsberg. I want to thank our engineers at Heritage Radio and Heritage Radio. And I'm Sam Benrubi, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.